This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, how are you?
Not too bad, Tom. How you doing?
Ah, you know, pretty okay. What are you drink? What is that tiny can you're drinking?
It's tiny. This is a tiny can of Coke.
I've never seen that before.
Tiny can of Coke. Yep.
You ever see that picture of Andre the Giant where he's holding on to a can of beer?
Yeah. I do that. I only buy small sodas so my hands eat beer. That's how it's a subtle move I do around the house. Here.
Yeah. For Zoom calls only. Like you have a shot of his can. Hey, I'm Tom Power, and welcome to The Q Interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio 1. How are you? Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for listening or streaming or downloading wherever. I'm always trying to imagine, you know, when I do radio shows or podcasts, I'm always trying to imagine where you might be when you're listening to this. You know, it helps me out a little bit. Like for some reason, I'm always imagining in line at a drive-thru. Maybe that's where I do a lot of my podcast listening, is in line at a drive-thru waiting for like a coffee or a Boston cream donut or something like that. So if that's the case, I hope it's moving fast. Today on the show, you're going to hear from Danny McBride, who is the creator of one of the best TV shows I've ever seen. It's called The Righteous Gemstones. I'll tell you more about it in a second. But before we get to Danny, on the show, we've been answering some of your listener emails, which has been very fun for me. Caitlin Swan, our producer who normally brings these emails to the show, she's homesick right now. But because she is such a consummate professional, she recorded herself reading the listener email to me. And I think we have that queued up. Go ahead, Sam.
All right, Tom. We're keeping listener mail super short and sweet today. And I picked this one because it's such an important question. I think a lot of people are probably asking this about you. So here we go. Hi, Tom. Love your show. Question. What's with the Hawkins cheesies on your Twitter page?
Well, if you're on, thank you, Caitlin. And by the way, you sound like you're still very sick, and I hope you're getting some good rest. I am from St. John's, Newfoundland. I know I don't talk about that very much. I try to keep it on the DL. But I'm from St. John's, Newfoundland. And in Newfoundland, for whatever reason, we eat a tremendous amount of Hawkins cheesies. In fact, like earlier this week, I think there's some supply chain problems in Newfoundland right now. So the Lay's chips and the Ruffles chips aren't getting to the island right now. And down the aisle in the supermarket, you're seeing like so many Hawkins cheesies. I thought they were a Newfoundland product. I thought they were made in Newfoundland until I went to Belleville, Ontario, and found out they've been made there. They are the best cheesies. They are my favorite snack. They make me so homesick. I am definitely not asking you to send me bags of Hawkins cheesies. Definitely not. Don't do it, whatever you do. So when I needed to find a Twitter background, I don't know. I don't really like Twitter, and I'm sort of off Twitter right now. But I needed to find a Twitter background, and I thought, why not put my favorite snack up there? It feels like it says a little bit about me in that I love salty fried snacks that are bad for me. If you have a listener email, send it to me, q@cbc.ca, q@cbc.ca. Caitlin, I hope you feel better soon. This Danny McBride interview is interesting because, you know, I had watched like one or two episodes of The Righteous Gemstones in order to get ready for the show. And after this has never really happened before. After the interview was over, I ended up watching the entire thing, like watching it the night it came out. It is a spectacular show because it's not just a sort of a mystery. It's not also just a hilarious show, but it is about evangelists of mega churches in the United States, you know, power hungry televangelists, their mega church. And it's sort of like a ludicrous version of the other HBO show Succession, in that there's a big father figure who is this, you know, empire owner, and he has to figure out, you know, how he's going to divvy this out to his kids as he gets older. And I can't say enough about it. Danny McBride, one of the funniest people in the world, shows like Vice Principals and Eastbound and Down. And he's done something very interesting, is that he has a very characteristic sort of auteur way of looking at comedy and television, never seeming pretentious. It's all so accessible. I think he's so brilliant, and I love what he named his cat.
This is Dr. Ned Biscuits. my daughter named him.
I love how she made him a doctor.
Yeah, he's been to school. He's
he's licensed.
Yeah, you got to say his full name. You can't just, you know, make it Ned or Biscuits. It's Dr. Ned Biscuits. It's like, a very formal thing.
Even when he's being bad, like he's chewing it. Yeah. Hey, Dr. Ned Biscuits, stop it.
That's it.
Hey, congratulations on the new season.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
For people who haven't seen it, can you tell us a little bit about you and the show and your character?
Yeah, you know, I play Jesse Gemstone. He is the eldest child of a megachurch family. It's run by, you know, John Goodman's character Eli Gemstone and his late great wife Amy Lee Gemstone. They built a Christian empire, and they have three children that are just complete nightmares that are sort of like being tasked with like continuing the empire and keeping the show running. And it's a great question to know whether they're capable of that or whether they will be able to.
The cast is amazing, as you mentioned, out of this thing. So I want to listen to a clip from season one. This is where the Gemstone kids are watching a movie together when one of the youngest of the siblings, Calvin, who's played by Adam Devine, starts crying, saying that he thinks he's Jesus.
I mean, you might not be I know that you are not Jesus Christ, but that don't mean you're still not a decent man.
I don't want to be a decent man, Jesse. I want to be Jesus.
Ooh. I'm also hearing another voice, and he whispers to me, and he says things like,
if you can't be him, then maybe you can be me.
Wait, what? Who's that one?
Satan, I think. I'm just one of many righteous men in this family. Perhaps I'd be more special if I were the dark lord of the group.
Calvin, you sound thirsty as fuck. You need to go lie down, boy. Get some night-nights.
I do. I'm so tired.
That's the adult children of the Gemstone family. I love that you're laughing while I play you that clip.
Adam and Edie just kill me. They're like, I cried so much when we shot that scene. It was like a scene that we filmed all night long, and anything past like 1 a.m. With those guys ends up just being like everyone getting pretty punchy and enjoying our jobs.
What is it about these characters that makes you laugh so much?
You know, I think there's just this, you know, I think it's just their immaturity. I mean, there's like they're just so sort of entitled and sort of like lacking in so many things that adults should have, like to be able to navigate relationships and situations. And I think that's kind of fun. It's fun to play characters that deal with things that other people have to deal with, whether it's loss or, you know, trouble in your marriage or trying to figure out how to raise your kid, but like portraying someone who has, who just does it and goes about it in such a foolish, insane way is kind of fun.
Yeah. And I should add, they're watching the horse drowning scene in The Never Ending Story in that clip too, right?
And they laugh at it. Yeah. They think that it's funny.
What does that tell you?
Sickos.
John Goodman plays Eli Gemstone, as you mentioned, the patriarch of the family. And I hear that John wasn't considered for the role at first, but you never thought John would be playing this role.
Well, that would have been like well outside of the realm of anything I thought would be possible. I mean, I've grown up just loving Goodman's work and always thinking he's just such a legend. And so when they suggested, like when they had asked, like, who did you think of for this? And they said, like, you know, sort of, I think it was like, you know, somebody like John Goodman, you know, and they're like, well, what about John Goodman? It's like, oh, well, I mean, it's John Goodman. He's not going to come and do a TV show with us. And we sent him the script and he responded to it. And I got on the phone with him and yeah, he said he liked it and wanted to come down and party with us. And so then we got him on board. It was kind of mind blowing.
Did you know him beforehand? Had you met him?
I had never met him before. No, nope. I know. I still feel like whenever we're doing stuff, like it doesn't seem like it's like a real thing. So anytime that somebody has like a real career, you're like, really? They want to come and work with us?
Yeah, but it's a big show and you've been on a lot of big shows. It's not like you're making a web series here. No disrespect to web series, you know?
I think my mindset is still that I am, you know?
Well, I want to play you a clip from the show. It's a song from the show that kind of went viral and got a lot of people watching it. Just take a listen to this.
Teacher said don't, but I said it anyway, misbehaving.
Preacher said no, if you do, you're gonna pay misbehaving.
Kicking and spitting. Yeah, so Amy Lee, the matriarch of the family, you know, she was a Christian child singer that she had a career with her brother. And they had a hit called Misbehaving. You know, we wrote it into the script that they had this hit. And we never really thought about what the song was going to be, though. We got to the episode where you were actually going to see them perform this. And it was sort of this moment of like, oh, well, what is the song Misbehaving? What is this? You know, and Joey Stevens, who does the music for the show, we've worked with Joey since The Foot Fist Way and Eastbound and Down, Vice Principals. He's our composer. He's just a genius. So whether he's scoring things or wanting to try to come up with something that's so period specific and kind of authentic as this, we like the idea of like, well, what is this song? Let's figure out how to crack it. And Edie and myself just kind of like, you know, Edie asked me, she's like, well, what did you think the song is? And I think I had like thrown out that Mama Told Me Not To, I Did It Anyway, Misbehaving. And then Edie started laughing and we just started kind of writing lyrics back and forth of what these kids could do to get in trouble. And we probably like got it about half cocked and sent it over to Joey. This happened in like probably about 15 minutes. And we sent it over to Joey and then he just kind of like finished the lyrics and then sang it and put it to music and then sent it back to us about an hour later. And it was this kind of crazy moment where we created this song in moments, you know, and it ends up sort of being such a crucial point to that season and kind of like adding legitimacy to who Amy Lee was. And it was awesome. It was a really fun thing to create. And it was really incredible to see Nettles, you know, sing it and bring it to life with Walton Goggins. And I don't know, it was wild.
But I think what's wild about it is that, how do I put this? Like, it's not only funny.
Yeah, it works.
But it's also kind of earnest and kind of sweet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what we wanted it to be. You know, it's like, you know, one thing we learned on Eastbound and Down, like we first set that show up, you know, like, oh, this is this asshole pitcher and he's retired and, you know, he's a joke now. People make fun of him. And we kind of struggled writing that. And then there became the point where like, what if he was really good? Like, what if that was the whole deal, is that he was actually really good? And then it becomes a story about someone who's kind of like squandered their gifts. And it really changed the whole like dynamic of the show for us when we looked at Kenny that way, that he wasn't just a joke. He was representative of something else, that he was actually good at what he did. And we use that same mindset with the Gemstones. That we're like, at the end of the day, they should be like legit. They should be good at what they do. It shouldn't be a joke. If what they do is a joke, then you're starting to make jokes about the people who go to church, which isn't really what our goal was. You know, it's like the idea is sort of like the butt of the joke are these sort of like these shysters. And so they need it to feel legitimate. Their enterprise needed to feel like it was real. And so I think that song weirdly kind of feeling authentic and real, I don't know, I think it kind of serves that purpose where it gives you this peek that there's a backstory, that there's a reason why they're here. They're actually good at it.
More of my conversation with Danny McBride coming up in just a second. Hope you enjoyed that product, service, album, song, cat boot company that you just heard about. And here's more of my conversation with Danny McBride. Where did the sort of germ of the show idea come from? Was it like watching? I know whenever I'm in the States, and there's a little bit of that here in Canada, and it's probably more of it than I know about. But I know sometimes when I'm in the States, I like if I get home late in the night, I'll sort of channel surf in the hotel room and find a wacky televangelist program and kind of
it definitely is all over the place. You know, I moved out of LA in 2017 and moved down to Charleston, South Carolina, in the South. And you know, I grew up going to church. I went every Sunday. My parents were really involved in church. My mom was she did a puppet ministry for children as when I was a kid. And so I just had experience with growing up in a religious household and going to church every Sunday. And, you know, I moved up to L.A. when I got out of film school and, you know, just didn't really think about church much, you know, since then. And I moved here to Charleston and suddenly there were churches everywhere. You turn on the radio and it's one religious station after the next. And I don't know, it just kind of brought back these memories of my experiences going to church. And then I was just curious of like, what is church like now? Like, how has it changed since when I was a kid? And then I started just kind of doing these deep dives in these mega churches. And it just felt like such a ripe sort of place to set a story, I guess.
Did you go to any of them? Did you drop into any of these mega churches and see what it was all about?
I did. Yeah, I did. I peeked in on a few.
And?
You know what? A few of them I went and I was like, damn, if I stay here longer, I'm going to end up going to this place. It's like they it is fun. Like they make a show of it. They make it awesome. I mean, it's like, I feel like if I was a kid and had been taken to that, I don't think I would have like dreaded going to church every Sunday. You know, church when I grew up, it felt so boring and you like were kind of forced to sit there between your parents and doodle while a preacher just yammered on. And with these mega churches, they really tried to like take that part of it out of the equation and really sort of like give you something that's entertaining and exciting and big, you know? And
maybe this says more about me than anything else, but I think when I first heard about the show, I thought it would be just kind of making fun of religious people. Oh my God, there's no shortage of shows that do that. But I think at least in the beginning of season one, and I don't think it's a spoiler, you treat small town preachers and pastors with great decency and great respect. Like the show isn't about that. The show isn't making fun of that.
It's definitely not, you know, it's like, you know, I've said it before, but it's like, I don't really know enough about what I believe to sort of, you know, have some sort of statement and cast judgment on people who believe something similar to me or dissimilar to me. To me, I just felt like this sort of idea of a minister who kind of sees themselves as bigger than the word just felt like an irony that was just too good to pass up. You know, with a lot of the other shows that we've done, it's like, you know, like vice principals, even like Neil Gamby, he sort of like lives his life by a code. He's a vice principal. He enforces rules and he's all about following those rules. And then behind closed doors, he's like not following any of these rules or following this code. And it sort of leads to his destruction. So I've always like been interested in characters like that, like characters that are so forward about what they believe in, but then struggle to sort of meet those standards behind closed doors. And this just felt like the ultimate example of that.
Have you heard from any like televangelists or like religious groups?
You know, none of them call me anymore. I used to have, I haven't heard from any of them. You know, what's interesting is I do hear from people though that had a similar upbringing to me, you know, people who might've grown up in the church and, you know, for, you know, politics or whatever sort of nonsense that sometimes churches can get caught up in that, I don't know that there's people see this and they can recognize personalities or character types that sometimes are drawn to this profession.
Did you say your mom did a puppet show?
She did. She did like children's puppet ministry. So she had like a stage and all these puppets and she would write these little scripts, you know, every week. And then they would like, you know, all the kids would come up during sermon and she would like do this like, you know, 5 to 10 minute little morality tale, you know, that kind of coincided with whatever the big sermon was for the week.
Oh, wow. So like there'd be like a bunch of puppets talking about chastity or like honesty or
yeah,
not
like
stealing.
Like that, like honesty, you know, just like the bait, you know, what, you know, pride, any of the type of things that, you know, that you know, that you're kind of, you know, guided through.
Was that your first taste of like theater or acting or any of that stuff?
It probably was. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, even just the idea of like watching my mom, you know, on a word processor type these like scripts up and have to like print 3 copies of them to give to her and like, you know, the 2 other deacons that were going to be voicing the puppets that week, you know, and then watching it all be thrown together. And, you know, it was a small thing, but yeah, I remember like going to church early so that she could set the stage up and, you know, yeah, it's cool.
Is she still with us?
Yeah. Still around. Yep. The puppets are in boxes now. They don't mold children anymore.
Has she seen the show?
She has. Yeah, they watch everything that I do, for better or worse.
Does she into it? She dig it?
I think that she is into it. I mean, I think that she would be kind of into anything that I would do, because I'm her son, unless it was like maybe a snuff film or porno or something. But I think she is just proud that I'm like making a living, maybe more than like what the content is.
And so I don't know that much about this, but from what I understand, like acting was not something you had your eye on your entire life.
It wasn't really. I went to film school in North Carolina. That's where I met Jody Hill and David Green, the guys that I work on the show with. And John Kachuri and Jeff Bradley were on the writing staff. We all went to school together. And yeah, that was my goal, was to just sort of become a filmmaker, to write screenplays and direct and do whatever. And I kind of just started acting just in my buddy's films, because we didn't really have access to a lot of actors. So we would always kind of recycle each other into our different student films. And so I started just kind of doing that as just favors. And then I could just memorize the lines better than the other guys could. So then I just kept doing it, I guess.
But did you like it? Like, did you find you had an affinity for it and you liked it?
I did like it. You know, like I did. Like, I mean, I like all aspects of creating, especially when it comes to like movies and television. I like it all. I like the idea that with that as a specific art form, collaboration is so much the key about it all, you know, like that from collaborating with actors and musicians and set designers and costume designers and cinematographers. I don't know. There's something about it that's just so much fun. And it's been cool to be able to go through that path as an actor as well, because I end up being on sets of people like Ridley Scott, or, you know, and be able to sit and watch what he does and how he runs his stuff. And then I can go and take those tips and throw it into my own stuff. And, you know, it's been, as someone who just loves the process, it's been awesome to be able to see it from a few different points of view.
I saw you laughing in the intro when I described your characters as all sort of like despicable, but lovable.
I like despicable is good. Yes.
But you know what I mean by that, right?
I do. You know, it's like, I think that like what we try to do with a lot of the characters that we've taken off as writers is just, we like the idea of like complicated protagonists. Like, I feel like it's kind of boring to start a story with somebody who just is admirable and they're who you should be. There's something that's kind of like, okay, you know, I've seen it before. I think starting a show or a story with a character where your first question is like, why am I following this person? Like, I feel like that's intrigues me. I like the idea of like, of taking someone like that and then taking the audience on like a really unexpected journey of like how they're going to feel about this person and what this person goes through.
Right. Cause I think The Righteous Gemstones gets compared to Succession. Like, it gets called like a comedy Succession sometimes, because both shows are about a big figure in, you know, in your case, religion, and in the Succession's case, I guess media, and the power struggles of the children trying to replace him. But I also thought that what your shows had in common was it sort of tests the limits, or shows me more about how empathetic I can be. Like, these people are either incredibly despicable or just kind of buffoons, but I can legitimately care about them and love them. And there's something maybe nice about that to me.
You know, that is part of it. I do feel like people are very, you know, we have a natural ability to be empathetic, humans do. And like, I think the more people exercise that, probably the better the world it would be at the end of the day. And I think that our shows, for instance, like tap into that, the idea that you can present someone as so off the wall as Neil Gambi or Kenny Powers. And then it doesn't take you seeing too many details to sort of like, not necessarily side with them, but kind of understand their struggle, you know, whether it's like they feel inadequate or their heart's broken. It's like, we all kind of tick basically the same way. We all want acceptance and we all want someone to love us, or, you know, to be able to love someone else. And I think when you start to see even the biggest monsters suffer with those same things we do, it's kind of hard not to at least understand them a little bit more.
I talked to Mike Schur this week. You know Mike Schur, like the writer, right, for like the Office and Parks and Rec. And,
yeah. I've never met him, but I know who he is. Yeah.
And he said something similar to me. I was asking him about, because The Office and The Good Place and all these shows, they're like funny shows about weirdos, but ultimately have a lot of heart at the end. And what you said about Eastbound and Down and this show rings true to me too. And we talked a little bit about how that sort of meeting the time. And he said something that like the 90s was such a great time for like just purely cynical comedy, like Beavis and Butthead, Seinfeld, just pure, no real lessons, no real heart. But there's something about this time that lends itself well to shows like yours and to his, and I guess to Ted Lasso and all that stuff too. Do you ever think about that?
You know, there probably is something to that. I mean, it definitely feels like part of the sign of the times now is like, maybe things didn't turn out as good as we all thought they would, you know? And like, that's sort of like what all these characters are sort of like struggling with, is this idea that maybe they had a vision for themselves of how things would be. And it's about kind of adjusting to the way things really are, you know. And maybe some of it is just being programmed by movies so much, you know, like that story structure in the 80s and into the 90s, where like good guys suffer and then they win and they do this. It creates a very like black and white way of thinking. And so the idea that narratives would like naturally kind of go into a more gray area feels like in some ways is probably like an answer to those kind of stories.
It's funny, you were talking about Ridley Scott earlier, and because you're getting to work with people like Ridley Scott, and I should point, in addition to doing comedy, you've done a lot of stuff. Like, you were great in Alien Covenant, you co-wrote Halloween in 2018, but of course, like, the majority of what you're known for and what you do is comedy. So we had Seth Rogen on maybe a couple of months ago, and he had something really interesting to say about where comedy lines up with a lot of other genres. And this is what he said. Just take a listen to this.
I can tell you for sure, as someone who has done this a very long time, nothing is valued less on this planet creatively than comedy. It is by far the least valued creative output. Like, no one thinks anything is easier than comedy. It is not viewed as something that is hard to do.
That's Seth Rogen on cue. My guest is Danny McBride. So what do you make of that?
I think he's right on. I do. I agree with him. I think that, that people think that if something's funny, somehow it's not art or it's not something that's elevated, you know? And it's true. I mean, you know, you really feel it when you go out and you have to like sell a movie. Like when you go out and have to do the press for movies, it's crazy the way the journalists will treat you if you're pushing like a comedy that kind of doesn't connect, or if you're pushing like a sci-fi or horror that doesn't connect. Like, there is this element of, of people, they give you a pass when it comes to other genres. And somehow when you fail people in comedies, they like hate you for it. Like, if they didn't get the joke or didn't like it, there's a meanness to their to the way they sort of critique the piece. You know what I mean? And I think that helps build to the idea that people don't respect it sometimes. I think it's an easy thing for people to criticize, but it's also like rarely ever like celebrated. It's like when you think of how many like best pictures have been comedies, it's like crazy to think how few there really have been, you know. And it's not like they're any easier to make or anything. I mean, it's like they're just as hard as making something that's dramatically complex.
Yeah. And I think the reason for that might be because they're functional. Like, he goes on in that clip to talk about how he said, like, when I was making Superbad, or when I was making, you know, when we were making Knocked Up, he was trying to get laughs per minute. Like, if they didn't get a laugh from an audience in like a minute, it was a failure. And he goes on to say, I'm not going to mention the director he mentioned, but he goes on to say, like, movies that are referred to as humorous aren't held to that same standard, but ultimately get more critical acclaim. So maybe when the reason a sci-fi movie or a drama doesn't connect, you can like you can sort of maneuver it and say, oh, well, it has a higher meaning, or it's a metaphor, it's an allegory.
Yes,
but a comedy has to do certain things. Like, you gotta laugh at it, right?
It's so true. And like, well, it's like the other part about a comedy is that it's one of the only genres that like you can tell in the theater whether it's working or not. You know, like, you can sit in a very dramatic movie theater that's the audience is completely silent for 2 hours, and you have no clue what the audience around you has thought about the movie. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, they can be quiet because they're thinking about it or moved by it. In a comedy, it's like, if people around you don't laugh, it changes all the jokes. It changes everything. It starts to create an effect that this isn't connecting. And for something with audiences, when they feel that it's not connecting, it turns and it becomes embarrassing, you know? And then you're not on board with what the jokes are, because you feel like you've outsmarted it.
So what's the indicator for you that you know that you're happy with what you made?
You know, that's what's so crazy about TV is that it's, you know, at least if I was doing like live theater or something, you'd perform it and then you would understand what the audience's reaction is there. And even when you make movies, you get to kind of test them, or you have a premiere and you get to really see in person what people's reactions are to the jokes or to the moments, the pacing. TV, it's like you work on this thing and then you just send it out there and then you never get the audience reaction, unless it's like someone comes up to you in a airport and tells you the line they liked, or, you know, it's like you never have that moment to truly see like what all did they laugh at, what didn't they laugh at, what worked, what didn't. So you really are sort of like creating a message in a bottle and just like throwing it out there and hope it lands on a friendly shore.
So what do? You just rely on like...
I just rely on my own taste, you know? I just try to rely on what would make me laugh and what I would find interesting. And it's just sort of trying to have that ability, like being able to watch something for the first time, even though you've watched it a million times, and just try to put your mindset into an audience with fresh eyes and just try to be them and try to figure out where they're going to bump and where they're not going to bump.
Does bump mean laugh?
Or maybe it means it bumps them out of the story and they're not like, oh, that joke didn't work. And then because that didn't work, they didn't laugh at the next thing either. I think you have to kind of like try to anticipate what they're going to do.
What I love about that is like, again, how to put this, like, I think I've always been really interested in this in the people I've got to talk to on the show, that like, when you make your first thing, it's easy just to make a thing that makes you laugh and makes your buddies laugh. But then as there's more money involved and or you have a legacy or you have a fan base or you have studios or you have all that stuff, I'll say, it can get in the way of it. So it's like, it's nice to hear that you can still just rely on, hey, this needs to make me laugh first and foremost.
You know, when you don't have anything else to rely on, it's kind of what you have to, you know, because yeah, I mean, it's like I've been doing this long enough and I enjoy the medium and I watch stuff myself. So I kind of feel like my taste is refined. I know what bumps me and what doesn't. So it just, you know, you follow it. And I've been really lucky that I've come up with guys like David Green and Jody Hill. And we all don't have the same sensibilities. We all have like completely different sensibilities. And there's something that happens when we create together that we sort of ride a different line together. And I think just from knowing... So I think in some ways it affects all of our sensibilities in a fun way, you know? And so you kind of also use the people around you that you trust to sort of see what's getting them excited, see what they're having fun directing or what sort of stuff they're not looking forward to directing in the season. And then you kind of just tweak the writing to that.
But before we go, and you've been generous and it's lovely to talk to you. I also, as a professional wrestling fan, like a long time wrestling fan, I love the way you treat wrestling in this show. Just the little bits I've seen of those moments of, I mean, I won't spoil how wrestling comes into it. In particular, like South wrestling, like Southern wrestling, which is its own thing, right? Like it's its own.
Yeah, it was that Memphis wrestling, especially the late 60s there. It's just, it was just a really cool time period where they're creating these crazy characters and there was fights over who had control of what territories. It was just sort of a rich time period for the sport.
Do you see a connection between professional wrestling and televangelism?
You know, in the show, it's like that connection is sort of made, and you know, you can read into it what you want if you believe that or not, but it definitely feels like in our story, Eli's history with wrestling has served to, you know, to maybe help him in his preaching endeavors.
I'm looking forward to the Jerry Lawler cameo.
Yeah,
let's get him in here. Danny, nice to talk to you. Thanks for making the time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Danny McBride is one of the stars of The Righteous Gemstones. He is the creator of the show. Season 2 just wrapped a few weeks ago on HBO. If you go to watch the show, I find that, and this is just me, the first like 4 or 5 episodes make the show sound like it's going to be this like suspenseful action show. And then after they sort of, I'm not going to spoil it, but like it also becomes this unbelievably funny show like no show I've ever seen. Thanks a lot to Danny for coming on. Don't forget to send your listener emails into us, q@cbc.ca, and we'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.